Wave. Bounce, yeah. Bounce, bury on this. Bounce. Damn, I free, but them don't see me. On the low, steady, kind of lazy. I got the wave now, rapping for my city. On my hustle now, I pray I see a milli. Already know, I've been moving on the low, studio to the show, London town, that's the base, I'm in and out last kitty, bad boy, swerving in my own lane, I think I'm Hamilton or P. Diddy, pretty Floyd with the hooks, I think I'm doing pretty good, I remember they didn't wanna know, now the stylist give me looks, other models to the floor, fashion week in New York, I said she more than for St. Laurent, but we could do sushi when I'm off tour, she from Cali, look like Gigi Hadid, bougie girl, but she like Hennessy. Party girl, she's always on the scene. Her mind is dirty, but she dressed it clean. Yeah. We up, we no one come down it. 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 Am I free, but them don't see me. On the low, steady kind of lazy. I got the wave now. Rapping for my city, on my hustle now. I pray I see a milli. You know we on fire. You know we on fire. You know we on fire. The whole world know we on fire. They ain't seen me in a while. I've been making money pile up. Studio the bando, steady cooking that fire. I flood the streets with a wave. I see my price going high up. I know the keys in the roost. My cheat code don't lose. I'm OJ with a juice. Call me Hines with a sauce. Can't catch up to a boss. You behind, you lost. I got the girls going wavy. They tsunami when they see me. I'm in the game getting coins up. Mario Luigi. Oh, we steady on that hustle for a man, go to LA. Yeah, I'm a lost, okay. We don't care what to them say. Yeah, one lane, move out, Danny. I'm TD day. Yeah, I told TD. Oh, I TD day. We up, we no one come down. We up, we no one come down. We up, we no one come down. Yeah, we up, we no one come down. Them are free, but them don't see me. On the low. Steady kind of lazy. I got the wave now. Rapping for my city. On my hustle now. I pray I see a milli.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever time of the day you're listening to this to, you are listening to No Man's Land RSA. We are your hopefully favorite podcast, or maybe the only podcast that you listen to. Although I know that podcasts aren't really that popular in South Africa yet, we're hoping to change that. Today's episode is called Bridging the Gap. So I understand that there have been quite a few issues concerning race at the moment, not even just quite a few, actually a lot. And we feel that this is something that needs to be addressed. Eugene will not be joining me today. He's having connection issues. But I have brought a man by the name of Denzel on the show today. Denzel, if you'd just like to quickly introduce yourself, tell us what you're about, drop your Instagram handle, go ahead.
All right. Well, hello, everybody. My name is Denzel Mhlongo. I'm the Minister of Joy and Entertainment, known as @TheMinister himself on Instagram. And I suppose my name says it itself. I mean, I'm the Minister of Joy and Entertainment. I make people happy, I entertain, but I think I also inform the people. So, yeah.
Okay. So I'm really excited for today's episode. We've called it Bridging the Gap, bringing white conservative views, being mine, and black liberal views together to discuss the issues of race that concern our great country and our entire world at the moment. It's actually quite interesting. I think everyone's just basically forgotten about coronavirus lately. And this is the new hot topic on the block. So it's something that we should discuss. So we're just going to hop right into it. The first thing that I just want to preface at the beginning of the episode. I understand that there are a lot of conceptions about what white conservatism looks like, especially white male conservatism. A lot of people believe that white conservatives such as myself are racist, evil, white supremacists, white nationalists. I assure you, I do not subscribe to any of these views. I don't support them in any way. And I hope that during the course of this episode, after I've expressed a few of my views, you will understand a little bit better the mind of a white conservative, and just that it's not so much that we disagree with the problem existing, we just disagree with possibly how to solve it. Or maybe you and I, Denzel, will end up agreeing on a lot of things. So we can probably start talking about that. White privilege, that's our first kind of talking point today. Caleb, just run me through what white privilege looks like. Let's suppose I'm a total idiot. I've got no idea what it is. I'm an uneducated white person that thinks that it doesn't exist. Try and explain to me what it's about, how it manifests itself, how we can go about stopping it.
Right. Well, white privilege exists in this country in a way that's unique, because overseas, obviously, white people are the majority in their countries. But here, white people serve a minority and still somehow manage, whether intentionally or inadvertently, to assert their dominance as white people over other races. And so white privilege doesn't necessarily mean to say that, oh, white people are privileged and that they have all this money or whatever. It's just an inherent thing that comes with the color of white people's skin, that because they are white, their skin tone is one thing that they won't have to worry about. When they enter certain spaces, they're automatically assumed to have belonged there. There's no speculation, there's no curiosity of what is this person doing here. White people's languages are just naturally understood. There's almost an expectation that if you're going to communicate with a white person, you're going to speak English with them, and vice versa. White people just assume that they're going to speak English with another person they come across, regardless of whether the person they come across is white or not. Institutions like schools and universities tend to cater more towards white people and make situations more palatable for them. Everything kind of centers around their white student body, regardless of whether or not the student bodies are white, or the majority, sorry, of the student body is white. And so those are examples of white privilege, but the basic overarching way I can explain it is that white people may face problems in this country, but the one problem that they don't have to worry about is the color of their skin.
Yeah, no, I totally actually agree with you on that. It's one of the things where a lot of people, I've seen it on Instagram and that sort of thing, like, obviously, white racists are getting exposed everywhere on social media at the moment. It's very profound, actually, to me. I've never seen something quite like this in my 18 years of being on the planet. But one of the things that I definitely agree with, I love your definition of it, because I think a lot of what white conservatives find to be the problem with white privilege is that they don't understand that argument of it, that the one thing you don't really need to be worrying about is your skin color, because it's not going to hold you back. I definitely think that you and I can both agree that there are definitely black people that are more privileged than some white people. I think those privileges don't manifest themselves and exist because of their skin color. It's got a lot more to do with the other factors. So that's one of the things that I definitely also want to put out there. I think it's brilliant the way that you've explained it. I've always stood by that. I've never argued that all white people are more privileged than black people, and vice versa. Not all black people in South Africa suddenly, because of laws like BEE, are suddenly now more privileged than white people. I definitely do agree with your definition of it being that the one thing white people don't need to worry about is their skin color. That doesn't mean that they can't be disadvantaged. It doesn't mean that they can't be discriminated against in certain capacities. But for sure, the one thing that they don't usually need to worry about is their skin color. That much I definitely agree with you. One of the things that I've just got a question to with regards to white privilege. In countries like South Africa, like you mentioned, the fact that it's a minority here, but white people own most of the wealth. How would we encourage white people to both understand their privilege and then to, how do we solve it? Like, that's my question. Like, how do we go about solving things like white privilege? Do we actively attempt to empower black businesses and people? Do we simply acknowledge it and then move on? What exactly does it look like to solve and accept our privilege?
Well, white privilege isn't something that needs to be solved in my mind. I think it's just an inherent part of being white, but it's the way that white people use their privilege to solve other problems which we should look at, because white people are already in a position where they have so much more access simply because they are white. And I say that because as much as we can say that, oh, apartheid is over, we're not living in a totally post-apartheid system where the roles have reversed and now black people are in domination. There's still a lot of ways in which spaces are considered to be white. And so when you enter them as someone who is not white, you're kind of reminded of the fact that you're white and that you're not white, sorry. And so for white people, it's a matter of, number one, being educated on their privilege. I think that is the hugest failing of our education system and society in general, is that it doesn't educate white people on what exactly their privilege is. And once white people are educated on their privilege, it can kind of open their eyes to the disparity between them and other races and the difficulties and the challenges that other races face, and then how they can look at their privilege after having been made aware of it, educated about it, and examine it and see how they can then take that privilege and not necessarily help other people. We're not saying, you know, give handouts. What we're saying is use your privilege in a way that does good rather than be ignorant of it. And then when other people are suffering, blame it on other issues besides the fact that white people inherently have an advantage in the country because of the color of their skin. So I think the major issue is just for white people to be educated on their privilege and then how they can use their privilege to solve issues.
Okay, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it's definitely something that I've tried to do in my life. For like, I've told you this when I asked you to come on the show. I'm not sure how many people at home that are listening actually know this, but I grew up in Botswana, and I was actually having a really in-depth, really great conversation with a friend of mine called Rayo. She goes to St. Mary's DSG in Pretoria. So we basically grew up not in the same primary school, but we knew each other growing up. And one of the things that we kind of mentioned was, if anything, we can use Botswana as an example of, that's why I fundamentally believe that racism can be wiped out and that it doesn't have to exist. We were a class of 57 students in our grade 7 year. We represented something like 28 different nations, several different cultures, something like 7 different religions. And we all got along. I actually, to a certain extent, I'm not sure how much I regret it or how much I was ignorant to it. But when I arrived in South Africa, that was the first time that I truly witnessed real racism. I'd watched movies about guys like Nelson Mandela, for example, and I knew my history because my mom and my dad, they're both Cape Townian. They moved to Botswana, I think it was 6 months after they were married in 1996. And they basically told me all the stories. It's just, that was all it was. It was a story. Like, it wasn't something that I lived and understood. Botswana is a lot more, I would say, probably xenophobic than it is racist. And I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact that our first president, Sir Seretse Khama, he married a white lady called Ruth from England when he was studying in England. We gained our independence in 1964. I think it's 1964. I hope Botswana people that listen to this aren't going to tune me for being the date wrong. But we were a protectorate. We weren't really a colony. We were never truly colonized. And I think that's probably also got a lot to do with it. But my childhood in Botswana, it really did paint things in a different light for me. And it makes me believe that we can do away with things like racism. But one of the things, and I did mention to you, I think, but in a very limited capacity when I invited you on the show, is one of my things with BEE. I don't disagree with BEE or find issue with BEE from the perspective of correcting a wrong. I don't think that giving a hiring preference to black people is in some way racist, or that it is like a second coming of apartheid. My issue with BEE is that whilst I understand that it is an inherently discriminatory policy, because obviously white people are being excluded, it's fair discrimination. But I also understand and remain cognizant of the fact that any form of discrimination which is justified, if it is carried out for too long a period of time, if you allow people in power to corrupt the idea that was good, then that can become problematic. And the reason that I have an issue with BEE is more from the administrative standpoint. I think that in order for it to be successful, in order for people not to corrupt it and not to become corrupt as a result of it, there needs to be some sort of a quota goal, something that we must achieve, like percentage-wise, perhaps, that would allow us to kind of do away with the policy and then move forward with our country as a whole, and viewing everyone as being part of that country. And once we've like equalized everything out, that's a very obviously deep ask and deep question, because I could justify equality as being, let's only equalize the top 10% of the country economically, or I could say let's put a time limit on it. But how do you put a time limit on racism? Because even if they were oppressed for 400 years, maybe the effects of that is putting them back 800. So that's just my question around that. I'm not sure how I would go about solving that, and I would wonder what's your opinion on it.
Well, this is the thing. People are so quick to say, you know, 1994 and apartheid was so long ago, we need to get over it and get rid of BEE. But the thing is, our government is trying to implement policies to undo, like you said, 400 years. You know, so don't look at how long ago it was, look at how long it was lasting for. And our government is far from perfect. And I think that the implementation of BEE is incredibly flawed. But we cannot get rid of it, because it still is, even though in a limited sense, it's still serving its purpose. So instead of looking at the legislation and being like, well, it only serves a minority of the black people and it completely excludes every other race, then look at that and say, well, the great thing about our democracy is that we can pass comment. And so look at it and say, well, if this legislation isn't working, reform it. Don't get rid of it. Fix it in a way that more people and more black people can benefit from it. Because the point of the legislation, the point of BEE and the whole affirmative action policy in general, is to create economic access for black people. So if you take that away, you create a vacuum where now black people do not know where they're going to get their opportunities in a country where there's an inherently racist hiring culture. Because the fact that we have legislation like BEE is indicative of the fact that there's a culture of just automatically wanting to hire white people or other races because black people are viewed as unqualified. Why is it a chore for employers to hire black people? Why do they not feel compelled to implement BEE? And so I say that currently as it stands, BEE should be used as sort of like a stopgap until a better piece of legislation can be drafted, which kind of mitigates the limitations that exist in BEE and reshape it and reform it and make it into a better and more inclusive piece of legislation, rather than to eliminate it simply because it doesn't include enough people. Just make it more inclusive is my suggestion.
Yeah, no, like, and I agree with you completely on that again. I'm actually surprised that we're agreeing on so much. But one of the things that I've always discussed with my dad, obviously living in Botswana, I think less than 1% of the population is white, and we're also Afrikaans, at least originally. So like we make up like less than, I think it's 0.5%. So I've always asked my dad, like, Dad, what's your view on this kind of stuff? And my dad actually, I don't think he's on the right or the left really politically. I don't think he's a very difficult egg to crack. He's like an onion. You have to peel him back layer by layer and you never really know what he's thinking. But he has said, you know what, at the end of the day, our ancestors shot themselves in the foot, or like we've shot ourselves in the foot because of our ancestors. And I'm like, oh, Dad, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, well, son, look at like the perceptions that white people in South Africa, or that people worldwide kind of have of black people in systems like BE. And it's exactly like you said, they're perceived to be unqualified and that sort of thing. And he says, well, why do you think that exists? It's because we're always complaining, like as white Afrikaans people, that the government is so terrible. Like it's not efficient. It doesn't work well. And he's like, well, why do you think that happens? And then he says it straight up. It's because our ancestors prevented them from getting proper educations, and it prevented them from being valuable in the system. So you can't complain as a white person that the government is inefficient if you are part of the reason, or at least your ancestors are part of the reason why that exists. And he explained it very well. And like, that's always the view that I've kind of stuck by. When I sit in class, like now in like a private school with half of my class being black, I see a lot of progress. I look at some of my black classmates and my white classmates as well. And I'm like, this is our future. We can sit in a classroom, we can discuss issues, we can come to decisions and to conclusions that our parents and our grandparents simply can't. And I think that a lot of that has also got to do with the fact that those people, being our parents and our grandparents, they lived during apartheid. And I think there is a certain amount of anger and animosity and cultured racism that exists in those spheres that we do not have to the same degree, and that allows us to move forward by like remaining cognizant of our issues and our past, but then also saying, okay, it's time that we implement things that are going to allow us to move forward and not to constantly dwell. And I think that's one of the really important factors in us moving forward as a society in South Africa. But I think we've discussed SA a lot now, and I think we're going to end up discussing it again. But let's discuss the stuff that's going on in the United States at the moment, because that's one of the things that's, well, it's everywhere. And I'd like to discuss a few topics under that. But what do you think about like people posting a black square on Instagram? Do you think that's useful? Because quite frankly, I would qualify it as slacktivism. I think that's lots of white people doing the bare minimum to look like they're woke and to look like they care, but really they don't.
Well, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, some effort is better than no effort, but I guess no effort is better than an insincere effort, which I think is what showed itself in the posting of these black squares, because they showed that there were 22 million black squares posted and they couldn't even reach 12 million signatures on the George Floyd petition, which shows immediately that people don't care about this cause as much as they purport to. Because for me, whatever petition I see, I sign it, put my name, my email, and it goes through, because I'm like, I lose nothing and I've contributed. And if people's first piece of activism was a black square, when that came already days after we've been making a noise, like, guys, this is outrageous, what is going on? Then we have to look at those people sideways, because what they're doing isn't helpful. Up until that point, they have posted no information. They haven't engaged with what's going on. And then they post a black square to look like they're part of some great movement. And then the next day, they're back to posting happy birthday photos with their friends. So you begin to see that it's all performative and they just want to look like they're part of this thing. And guys, look, I'm not racist. I promise you, I'm part of your movement. I posted a black square because it is the easiest thing I could ever do without having to confront any of my biases, and just look and celebrate and clap hands for me, because I promise you guys, I'm part of your movement. That is what I gather from them posting black squares. It does absolutely nothing, because we've heard nothing from them before. The majority of them, we've heard nothing after. They probably posted one other thing on their story and then it's dead quiet and radio silence. So I think we're better off receiving information from them than just a black square.
Yeah, no, definitely. And my thing also, since we've now brought up like George Floyd, obviously that is a terrible case of police brutality. Yeah. And I don't doubt for a second that it was racism. But a lot of the discussion that's been brought up at the moment is the idea of systemic racism. And I've got a very particular view on that, but I don't want to warp my view by assuming what your definition of systemic racism is. So I'd like to just ask you, what would you define as systemic racism?
Well, I mean, it's in the name. It's the structures, the institutions, and the systems of a society which are designed, you know, to exert dominance over one race and keep one above the other and kind of create a gap between the races. And in this case, it puts white people at the top and black people at the bottom. And so there are structures which are designed purely to benefit white people. And then the way they are exerted on black people could be anything from disadvantaging them to completely excluding them from society to deliberately taking away their rights, their freedoms, their liberties. It's a lot, but at the end of the day, what systemic racism does is it creates a huge benefit for white people and a terrible disadvantage for black people.
Okay, now that I've kind of like got your definition, I think I can warp my basically package my view to a way that in a way that is palatable and that is possibly understandable. So I agree 100%. Systemic racism is a massive issue in the United States. If you look at things like Jim Crow, that was only like 60 years ago. Was it 60? Yeah, 60 years ago. The civil rights movement, even before that, slavery. That is a genuine issue that has caused a lot of trouble in the United States for black people. But when it comes to police brutality and to people going and turning and saying, okay, it's systemic racism, and then leaving it at that. I think there's a certain oversight that is happening that I think is limiting, and that I think is preventing them from tackling the issue effectively. So I've gone and read up a lot on multivariate analysis, like a few multivariate analysis case studies of police brutality in the United States. And the biggest correlation to police brutality is crime rates, the neighborhood you live in, and gang ties, that sort of thing. So we find that Hispanic communities with gang ties or with cartel ties are the ones experiencing the most police brutality in the United States. Now, that's not to say that Black people aren't experiencing it. I definitely think that they are. But I think that the issue of police brutality is largely in part due to two factors that are actually above that of race, being the inadequate training of police officers. I think they get like 160 hours of training, which is a lot less than like your average hair, like a barber has to get a lot more training than that. And they only spend 8 hours of their training on conflict resolution and de-escalation. They spend most of it learning to be violent. I think that's the first problem that we have to look at. The second thing is, I think it's far more an issue of class than it is of systemic racism. So systemic classism. And the reason why I think that's valuable but can still pay into the idea of it being systemic racism is that systemic racism, like you said, it's placed Black people at the bottom and white people at the top. So Black people happen to fall into both categories. They're both Black and they're in the lower class. So they're going to experience a lot more police brutality. So I don't so much disagree with the fact that it is systemic racism than I do. It is definitely a part of it, but I think the systemic classism is the bigger issue, and that's something that we should also be looking at dealing with.
Well, that's an interesting observation, but I think if we examine how the police function in America, then hopefully you'll see why we say it's systemic racism. Because historically, right, you mentioned the Civil Rights Movement, it was understood that the police were the force that made Black people scared. The police, members of the police force in America in the past and today, were also members of the KKK. And so it's difficult to separate racism from the police when in the past and today, the majority of police activity in Black areas in America is racially motivated, right? There was a study which shows that police in America don't think about the consequences of what they're doing when they know that the perpetrator is Black. And that is because of a doctrine in America which exists in their law called qualified immunity, which says that the woman was acting in good faith to stop a crime, then his killing of, we'll say in this case, a suspect, we won't say Black or white, is justified. And so that doctrine kind of absolves police of any guilt and any potential thought process in their mind that could say, if I kill this Black person, what is going to happen? And that, as well as the fact that we've seen a pattern of Black people being killed by police and police not being prosecuted. So we can see that the police look at Black people and say, ah, it's just a Black person, I'm going to kill them and then I'll get off scot-free. But there's less carelessness, or there's more care when officers deal with white people. I mean, look at how they deal with white school shooters. Children are handled more delicately. They're arrested, they're calm, they handle the white shooters better. But when it comes to a Black person, and in this case, George Floyd was suspected of using a fake dollar, they kill him. So I think in a lot of ways, American police activity is racially motivated when you look at the complete difference in how Black suspects and white suspects are treated. There's no way we can separate race from how the police function. I think it's an integral part of how they function.
No, I agree with the idea that you can't separate the race completely, right? But I definitely think that when you case study even countries that are far more ethnically similar or racially similar. So if you look at South Africa, for example, or you look at what's like a super white country, Sweden, I don't know, a super, super white country. I think you find, and the studies that I've read show that even in those countries, the poorer community or the poorer group of people are always the ones experiencing similar, if not exactly the same amount of police brutality and the type of way in which they are affected. And that's why my discussion or my reasoning as to how we should solve it is not so much just based around the race aspect. One of the biggest issues that I have actually with American politics is that I don't think that the Democrats or the Republicans are for black people. I just think the Democrats have gotten really good at getting away with it and acting like they actually care. Because when you look at things like, I'm like a very hardline capitalist. I love capitalism. I think that it's a really good system, but I think that it's very easily abusable as well. But my issue with the Democrats is a lot of the time they talk about things like social welfare, social grants, and basically handing out money to people that can't afford to live otherwise. I think that it creates a dependency in the black community, and that they're basically bribing a lot of black voters with the social welfare and with these policies and these ideas so that they keep getting into power and so that they can keep getting votes. And that's a problem that I have. I believe a lot more in giving people like actual money and then motivating them to start businesses, to start enterprise. And I understand as well in the United States, there's a very big stopping block in a way, that obstacles in black people's way. Because we look at guys like LeBron James or Michael Jordan or Will Smith, these successful black men, black women like Oprah and Michelle Obama and Barack Obama, we look at them and we're like, oh, well, if they can do it, the rest of the black community can too. But I think these are examples of people that slipped through the cracks and that managed. Yeah. And I think there's still a very massive issue there when it comes to that. But just in terms of the police brutality, when I think of something being systemic, I think of it being that the laws themselves need to be racist in some way. And you bring up the idea of, what's it called again? What's that law called again? The it was
affirmative.
No, not that. The law that basically lets cops get scot-free off, like if they act in good faith.
Oh yeah, qualified.
Qualified immunity. Yeah. So I've seen that post on Instagram, and I went and did a lot more research on this as well. The reason why I don't say that is feeding into systemic racism so much is that it would apply if they did it to a white person as well. I just think that because of the fact that the black community tends to be a lot more poor, obviously due to historically systemic racism, I think that poverty correlates a lot to crime rate. And then because a lot more crime is happening in those communities, they experience that police brutality. And that's why cops are getting off a lot more when it comes to black people, because they tend to be the ones that are in these high crime areas at no fault of their own. They're literally just being born into it, and they're constantly being put in that position by the system. So I think that's the systemic problem. It's not so much that law, although I suppose it's debatable. And then the other thing with systemic racism is if a majority of people within a system are abusing it and using it to be racist. Whilst I agree that there is a massive issue in terms of racism and stuff in the United States when it comes to police, I haven't seen enough statistical evidence to show me that a majority of police officers are the ones are racist. I think it's a minority that are extremely racist, and that those are the people that are being put out in the media and being portrayed. And I think that's creating a bit of a misconception. But I haven't seen the studies. If you could give me studies, or if someone could give me studies that shows that a majority of police officers in the United States are racist and acting with racial bias, I definitely would agree that it's systemic racism in the police force.
Well, I also say that if we're looking at it from a systemic point of view, and you say, well, they're in the poor areas, then if we take the geography out of it, there are still instances where black people unprovoked are attacked and aggravated by the police. I mean, I saw a video today of a man on a highway. A highway is neither a poor area nor a rich area, and a black man was there, and he was stopped by police, and the police refused to tell him why he was being detained. He called for backup, and then the two officers overpowered a black man. And so that's not to say that all of the police brutality is a case like that, but it's evidence of how the police don't care where they are or who they're around. If it's a black person, they are going to feel motivated to act in a way that is violent towards that black person. And I'm not going to say that the police are only violent towards black people, because the police are just violent in America, is what I've noticed. As long as they've got a mandate from their leadership, whoever it is, whether it's governors or the president, whoever, as long as they've got a mandate to say, seek and act in this way, identify this issue and solve it however you see fit, they will take it into their own hands. A group of peaceful protesters in America, for example, were tear gassed and had rubber ammunition shot at them by the police because Donald Trump wanted to walk out of the White House and go and take a photo. So I think there's a huge problem of, number one, the police just being a violent force and a force of tyranny on the police. The government, and especially Donald Trump, is using them as a weapon against his own people. That's the huge issue. And So when you take it into race, their violence almost becomes excused because they're operating in a system which doesn't necessarily care for black people. And so they show more care when it's white people, but in general, the police are a violent force. And where black people are involved, the police couldn't even care less. They'll probably even act even more violently towards black people. So the huge issue, number one, I'm trying to say, is that the police are violent. And that is where the issue of the system is. And
I think there we agree. Definitely agree without a doubt.
That they're violent, yes. Mm. And so when you add race into it and how police brutality in a lot of cases is racially motivated, we kind of see them exerting that anger more on black people as a force that is already a violent force. I think that is how I would put it.
Yeah, no. I definitely agree with you on the fact that it is also racially motivated. I think the place where we kind of divert pathways is that I believe that it comes to that conclusion for different reasons, or that other factors are predominantly more important than in that happening than just race alone. But I think we definitely both agree that there is a lot of racial motivation behind police brutality. I think we both definitely agree that it's a massive issue in the United States that needs to be dealt with, and that these people are extremely violent. And I actually, with the whole Donald Trump example, I actually, until literally right now, would often believe that people, I actually felt like Donald Trump, I thought he was a very mediocre president, like he's average, but I never thought he was as bad as what a lot of people said he was until right now, until he literally started doing the stuff that, because he has not displayed any form of genuine leadership during this time. I agree with the fact that he's using them as a weapon. This is the first time in like a very long time, or not a very long time ever, that I have seen where he has seemingly incited actual violence. I believe he is guilty of hate speech in this particular case. In every other case, I was like, okay, yeah, but like he didn't exactly say it, or he didn't straight up say, do this. Like he nudged it and he like aided to it in a way, but I'm like, okay, but that's politics. There's politicians that do similar things to this everywhere around the world. And I feel like he's just getting a lot of hate because obviously America's like the media center of the world. So I'm like, okay, I excuse this a little because I still kind of like his policy. And I like the way that it has been empowering minorities to a very large extent in certain areas, stuff like the School Choice Act that he passed. I do like his stance on illegal immigration. And I think that's one of the things that people often get confused because a lot of people feel like he's just against immigration in general. And I think there is elements of that that's true when it comes to stuff like Muslim country or Islamic countries and that sort of thing. But in general, it's more that he cares about the illegal immigration of people rather than just the immigration. So those kinds of things were where I battled and where I was like, okay, I kind of agree and I kind of disagree, but I just really don't mind the guy being in power for 4 years. And I was even at a point saying, you know what, I prefer this guy to Biden still, because Biden's like kind of senile and Biden isn't exactly clean in terms of his racial track record either. So I was like, okay, I'll probably still take Trump. But now after what's happened now, to be honest, I'd rather suffer a Democratic president again than see what this guy Trump is doing. Because honestly, it's just disgusting. Like he creates so much social unrest. And I like, part of me really wants to kind of like this guy, like, or at least the idea of him. Like he's just a billionaire he doesn't care about politics. He doesn't care about being politically correct, which is something that I quite like. I think that a lot of politicians are too politically correct and aren't giving us their true opinions on a lot of things. And I kind of like the idea of him coming out with this whole like fuck you attitude of I'm just going to say what I want and people are either going to like it or they're not going to like it. And then lots of people ended up liking it. But after just this week, I can't defend this man anymore. Like he's straight up, he is racist. He's a bigot. Like he really just needs to go. Like he's causing more trouble than the good that he creates. And I think there's a lot of good that came out of his presidency in terms of talking points. Like a lot of people weren't talking about immigration enough and stuff like that, which was something that I'd always found an issue with. But now, we don't need 4 more years of Trump. Like he can buy, he can leave now. Yeah. I actually wanted, are you familiar with Andrew Yang, the guy who ran in the Democratic preliminary?
No, I'm not. I wasn't really keeping up with the American elections this year.
Okay. Nah, but this Andrew Yang guy is, he's so cool. Like he's a pretty dope gent. Like he says stuff like, he named his presidential campaign, like his followers or whatever. He called them the Yang Gang, which I kind of liked. I was like, that's really good marketing. He had this whole idea of giving $1,000 to every American family every month to promote like economic growth. And he's like really intelligent when it comes to things like the AI. And he doesn't like the idea of automation. He likes the idea of giving jobs back to people. And I was like, okay, you know what? This guy's pretty moderate. Like he seems like someone who judges something at face value. He doesn't subscribe too much to his side of the aisle. Like he's not going to make a decision just because he's on the left, and he's not going to make a decision just because he's on the right. He's going to view both sides and say, okay, I agree with this side more. Let's go with that. Like I kind of like the idea of that as a president. I don't like the extremist candidates like Bernie Sanders or I almost wanted to say Hillary Clinton because she looks so much like Elizabeth Warren, at least to me. like they even have the same hairstyle. It's crazy. I really wanted him over guys like Biden, but I'll settle for Biden at this point, to be honest, because I understand that Trump is just bad for the country. Like if he ends up winning, I'm thoroughly convinced they should like launch some sort of massive investigation into how the entire system is rigged, because I don't believe that he can be voted back into power anymore. Like there's no way after all of this.
The Electoral College, I mean, that's that whole body. They're the body that determines whether or not someone is fit to be president. And so if they can look at everything Donald Trump has done over the past 4 years and then still say that he should run for a second term of office, then that Electoral College just needs to be eliminated totally because it's not serving its purpose.
Yeah, no, and I think a lot of what it is, I think us looking at it as South Africans, we're like, okay, yeah, no, this is crazy. This guy must dip. But probably like freedom of speech laws in the United States are really weird, dude. Like you can literally say whatever the hell you want, except kill him and you can be fine.
Exactly.
Which I also have a little bit of a problem with, because whilst I am a free speech activist and I think that like on university campuses and stuff, liberal students have really like gone out of their way to silence right-wing speakers, which I definitely think is a problem. And so I'm a free speech activist in that way. I'm like, I think everyone should have a platform to speak and be able to share their opinions, even if people like massively disagree with it. But like what the United States Supreme Court has decided in terms of like free speech laws, I feel like it's way too open for interpretation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've kind of discussed police brutality now. I think we can touch on a few SA issues before we close off. So like, I know we discussed the ideas of like farm murders and, Collins Corsa, also someone who died here due to the SADF kind of just being a super abusive. In terms of farm murders, I think as a white guy, Afrikaans guy, family that has actually gone in farming and has like ties to farming, I don't support this narrative. Like the fact that they're bringing it up now all of a sudden saying, you know what, guys, what about the farm murders? What about like, who cares about BLM? There's white people that are dying on farms. Like I don't even think that's a race thing. I think it's I don't understand why these people bring it up. Like I'm just sitting there and I'm like, how stupid do you have to be? Like you literally just want to tear down someone else's movement because it makes you feel insecure. Like you don't really have to do that. Like, at least if you're going to do it, make an intellectual point. Like, try and give me some sort of warped, false, totally derogatory stat that says that somehow white farmers are experiencing more brutality and violence than black people in the United States under a police regime. Like, at least hoy out a stupid stat that has no relevance and that is totally false, and use that as some sort of basis for making your argument. Because then I can just say you're a poor intellectual instead of saying you're a really bad person.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, I don't agree with it at all. I really don't know why people are doing it. Like, this is why I actually want to be a Motswana. Like, I want to be a citizen of Botswana instead of being South African. Like, I've got the citizenship, but I've lived in Botswana my whole life. That place, it's bad.
Well, I mean, it's strange how, I mean, we heard it last year. I think that's where it was loud, but not to this extent where, guys, look at the farm killings. But last year, it wasn't a look at the farm killings thing. It was a, we're living in a white genocide, the EFF is going to kill us issue. And so everyone was looking at these white people like, are you guys on drugs? Like, that's not what's going on. Yes, your farmers are being killed. And then women like Katie Hopkins and Lawrence Southern are coming and passing comment. The Australian Prime Minister is saying 400 farmers a year are being killed. And so it completely inflates the issue beyond what it actually is. And it kind of casts like this huge, you know, red mark on South Africa that look at what they're doing to their farmers. Their farmers are in a genocide. What are they going to do? And then now you bring it into today where you've seen how black people overseas are being brutalized. And even on our doorstep, people like Collins Khoza. And yet we can still say, okay, but guys, the farmers, where were you guys with the farmers in December? Where was all of that energy for the farmers? It wasn't there. And then now when there's an issue with black people and we're telling you guys, hey, please stand with us. Like, I can't stand with you guys if you're not going to talk about the farmers as well. Like, I'm not a political person, but just you have to talk about the farmers too. Like, we can't mix issues. These are separate conversations and we're having a big one right now, which you either are going to be a part of or are not. But don't contribute useless information like the farm killings to a conversation that is about police brutality and racism. They're just completely separate issues.
Yeah, like my big thing with that, the one thing that I will say, like, for sure, is I don't support the idea of people justifying farm killings, saying it's adequate revenge, because I think that's just stupid. It's not progressive. It doesn't help us. But I'm not going to stand here either and say, oh, no, it's totally justified to bring it up, like, all of a sudden, out of nowhere. Weren't saying it earlier, or at least you were, but you were calling it a white genocide. Now all you're saying is, hey, look at the farm murders, because we don't really want to focus on the fact that white people are kind of racist sometimes and, like, cause issues. Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's something that I've never understood as a white person. Let me put it that way. Like, I can't even put myself in that mindset. I as a white person have always been told and taught by my parents, by the schools that I've been in, by mentors, by friends, look, your ancestors kind of did some whack stuff. Like, you need to own that fact, and you need to work every day to be better than that. Like, I've always been taught that. And now, as a white person that didn't live in South Africa, but then had to rock up for high school because I wanted to have a more diverse sporting career, even though that the sporting part didn't work out, the diverse part did. I had to experience this stuff for the first time. Like, I'm willing to put it out there. In Botswana, for example, growing up as a white kid, there was never like the whole discussion, we were never taught the discussion of, like, racial slurs and their impact and why the N-word can be said by black people and why it can't be said by white. Like, we were never taught that, but mostly because, yeah, like, we didn't experience the effects of it. So in a way, there was almost no reason to teach it, because it wasn't causing offense and it wasn't causing any kind of feeling of being excluded. But when I arrived in South Africa, I remember, I was singing along to a song or something like that. Just like you see all these people getting exposed on Instagram for, I was singing along to a song with my friends, my new friends that I had made, and the word was there. And I said the word, and they immediately said, hey, well, you can't say the word. And I'm like, oh, why? I didn't know. It's in the song. And he's like, oh, no. And then they sat me down and they had the conversation with me and they said, dude, this is this and this is why you can't. I had the matrix. They got the matrix to speak to me. And I think I was a very isolated case, because for a lot of white people, especially now, what I see is they make the mistake and they've been making the mistake. And I can't speak to whether or not they ever had someone sit down and explain to them why they can't say it. But I think I was very, very blessed to be with a group of people in my boarding house that understood that me coming from Botswana, where it wasn't really a big thing, or it was never really an issue that we discussed, sitting me down and just telling me, hey, look, this is why you can't, instead of straight up demonizing me and like basically reporting me for racism, getting me expelled. Like, I'm still very grateful to those friends of mine that I had for explaining that to me so that I could understand it and that I could be better because of it. And that's helped teach me. So that's something that I've always tried to preach. But if it's someone that's been sat down time and time and time again, and they are still making the mistake, yeah, no, sorry, they're beyond help. I don't really care about sitting them down and having a nice conversation with them anymore.
Well, I think in South Africa, it's not a sitting them down and nice conversation thing, because I think our white people feel they're entitled to say the N-word because it wasn't used in South Africa, so why does it matter? Or it's in a song, I don't need it to be offensive. But that's not the point. The point is you're not supposed to use the word. That is what we're trying to tell you. But they refuse to listen. And so that disregard shows whether or not they want to believe they're racist. It shows that they are racist. Because if you can look at a racial slur and we can tell you not to use it, you can say, no, but it's my opinion. The fact that you can have an opinion about a racial slur shows that regardless of what you say, you are a racist.
Yeah. No, like, and one of the things that I will admit I have brought up when asked that, even though I don't use the word and I don't want to somehow advocate for white people using the word, one of the questions that I've always asked just to challenge my black peers, like I've got quite a few really close friends that I usually debate these issues with, I ask them, well, what about artists like Lil Wayne that have come out and said, I make my music for all people of all colors. If you're singing along to the song, as long as you're only saying it when you're singing along, that's fine. Just don't use it recreationally. I personally feel like, why don't those artists get any kind of like condemnation? And is there some sort of issue that exists behind the idea of some black guys taking the word super seriously and then other ones, they have white friends that they give like the N-word pass to and that sort of thing? Like, is that something that we should be discussing more in school, like making it part of a curriculum and teaching people this is why you can't? Or how would we go about that? Because I would like to see that solved.
Yeah, I think that racism really does need to be taught in schools because it is not being taught in schools. And I think with the N-word and that whole N-word pass thing, it's fun to make the joke with your wife, like, ah, I give you the N-word pass. But at the end of the day, don't use the N-word. It is a racial slur, regardless of whether or not you consider it to be offensive or you mean it to say it offensively. Just don't use it because it's not allowed. I don't know how we have to say it. I don't know how many languages you have to say it in, because it just is not allowed. If black people use it, it is because they are black. And when white people use it, you cannot use it because it is racist. Yes, it is in a song. Yes, one rapper might have said, I make it for all people. But at the end of the day, it is a racial slur. And white people need to understand the offense behind that word. I think they just don't see it as offensive. They see it as any other swear word, but just a swear word for black people. And unfortunately, that is a slur and it is racist and you need to stop using it. I don't know how to express it to them that it just cannot be used.
No, I definitely agree with you. I wouldn't disagree. One of the things that I have also wondered about before, though, and I think once again, it was a really good and informative video that you made, and that's how I basically got to see it. I remember to drop it in the description of the podcast and stuff, so people can also go watch that. But on the idea of, I think it's called, the term is coined as reverse racism. So it's the idea that black people can't be racist. Just one thing that I wanted to actually ask you about, because you said, like, I agree with the premise to a large extent of the idea that because black people don't have like systematic power in society, they can say racially like prejudiced things, but it doesn't classify as racism because they don't believe that their race is better, and they don't, the white person remains unaffected because they maintain their position, right? I am getting the gist of it. So my question was, you said in that video, or at least I'm pretty sure you said in the video, can you name one industry or one facet of life in which black people are superior. And that sort of thing. I will say, I do believe that the possibility for black people to be racist exists. I don't know that I can find many examples of it. But one of the things that I would bring up is, like, I don't know how well versed you are in the rap industry, but it was last year when Nick Cannon and Lord Jamar made diss tracks, like a couple of diss tracks, and they came at Eminem saying that rap is not a white person's industry. They don't belong there. He's a guest in hip hop. Would you classify that as racist? Because I certainly believe that black people have the power in the rap industry. It is their industry. It was their invention.
Well, it isn't racist. They were passing. It's a how would I put it? It's a cultural statement, because essentially what they're saying is true. It isn't a white man's industry. What hip hop and rap music were invented by black people in rebellion to a racist white system, and so when white people come in, they're absolutely going to be guests because they're rapping in an industry which was developed as a reaction to the oppression of black people, which is something that white people aren't going to feel. And so the creation of that space by black people and them not welcoming a white person in is purely a result of the fact that the industry was created by black people for black people. It wasn't a space intended to be occupied by white people, because it's a reaction against white people. And so I wouldn't call it racist. I would call it a cultural statement. Was it a nice thing to say? No. I think, you know, now anyone should be allowed to make whatever music they want, but Eminem cannot claim ownership and that he fully belongs there, because it is not a genre that was intended to be used or to welcome or to be in collaboration with white people.
Yeah, no, I think this is probably just the place where, like, you and I, for example, will disagree. I do feel right. That it was racist. That's what I feel. And just the line of the way that you phrase it makes a little bit more sense for me now, because it's not so much the fact that it was invented by, but rather the purpose of why it was invented by. So obviously hip hop rap, it was invented as a way to kind of like speak out against racism, against white people. It was meant to be for black people to practice and to express their views, because there weren't many other ways for them to do that. It's just, I fundamentally find problem with that, because it still fits the idea of the power structure. And if like, for example, the idea of it being a cultural statement, the reason it doesn't really sit well with me is that it creates almost a double standard, in a sense, at least from my perspective, that a black person in an industry that they created for themselves can say, yeah, you don't fully belong here. It was never meant for you. But something like basketball, that's dominated by black people, was invented by a white person. And I could go as far as to say it was invented by a white person for white people. But I would never argue that a black person doesn't belong. I would never argue that Michael Jordan and LeBron James don't belong in the industry of basketball. So maybe that's just a place where we can disagree. And I understand the idea of it was the reason why it's created, not the fact that it was created by. That's the reason why it's a cultural statement and why it isn't racist. So I'll take that into account, and I'll like think about that a little bit more deeply before I make my final decision. But at face value, I would still see it as racist. But that's just my opinion. And I believe that you and I can disagree. We don't have to agree on everything. We've agreed on a lot, actually, and I'm surprised that we've actually agreed on so much. And I think it helps to illustrate that at the end of the day, you as a black liberal, me as a white conservative, I think we want to solve the same issues, and I think we want to see the same change. We just occasionally disagree on how we should go about it. And I think there is room for that in society, and that's valuable in society. And the big thing that I kind of wanted to do with this platform, the reason that like me and Eugene, who unfortunately again couldn't be here today, the reason that we created a white conservative voice in something like podcasting and media, is because we felt that, first of all, the opinion wasn't out there enough, especially coming from our generation, but also that we felt that by doing it, maybe we could get a lot of white people who are conservative to actually start talking. Because I don't think you can ever really unite a nation or unite a generation without getting people to be willing to speak and be offensive. I don't know if you know the guy, his name's Jordan Peterson.
No, I don't.
Okay, well, I'll share some of his videos with you after this, and then you can tell me what you think. But he's this professor out of Canada, and he's spoken a lot about stuff like transsexuality. He doesn't disagree with transsexuality the same way that like Ben Shapiro, for example, does, but he disagrees with the idea of Bill C-16, like the law that compels you to use someone's preferred pronoun. Like, he has an issue with that. That's how he became famous, just for some context. But he has a really good quote in which he says, in order to be a thinking individual, you need to risk being offensive. And I think a lot of people, especially in society today, it's like people coin it as being snowflakey. To an extent, I agree. To a certain extent, I don't. I just think that people don't want to risk offending people because they're scared that they're the ones that are going to get like formed by the mob on like on social media and stuff. And I think we kind of need to move away from that if we're going to be successful as a society. Like, you need to risk offending each other in order to think, in order to create new ideas, to create better ideas, and to build upon like past experiences. So that's definitely something that I think is moving away. And it's something that we kind of need to bring back into society, like the willingness to possibly offend someone in the pursuit of truth. Because I've never believed that, for example, what I say is totally correct. And I don't believe that what you say is totally correct. I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And that's why we need to work to finding that. But it's been a pleasure having you on the show. If you have any final comments, please make them, and then we can close with the session.
No, I just think this has been a great discussion to have, to hear somebody on the opposite side. Well, not the two. I don't think you're on the opposite side at all. I think we are closer to the middle than we expect. It's just that the labels that are applied to our ways of thinking make us sound like we're on two opposite extremes. But it's been a fun discussion. I really liked it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Denzel. It's been a pleasure having you on. I certainly look forward to having you on again in the future sometime. Everyone who's listening, we're going to drop Denzel's Instagram on our Instagram page at No Man's Land RSA. Go and follow that if you haven't yet. If you have any opinions, any comments, we're going to be having a question sticker on our Instagram story, so you guys can engage with us there, and you can surely engage with Denzel. Maybe if this it gets enough hype, I think maybe something like a good idea would be maybe we go live or whatever on Instagram, because that does get a lot of attention and that sort of thing as well. So if Denzel's looking up to that at some point in the future, we might do that. But it's been a really great experience talking to you, Denzel. I really did appreciate it. And I think that, like you said, we're actually a lot closer to the middle. It's just the labels that are dividing us. And I definitely think we should get rid of the extremists and work more to be like us. I think this should be the gold standard of communication from now on. So thank you very much, Denzel. It's been a really great privilege speaking to you. And thanks for your opinion, because I think people are going to learn from this, and they're going to end up engaging a lot better when it comes to situations like this. So thank you.
It's a pleasure.